Fortunately, about the turn of the 19th century, as the 19th century turned to the 20th, a series of travelers and explorers discovered caves in Chinese Central Asia that were full of remarkable historical chronicles that help us begin to piece together a picture of life in Tibet and in surrounding cultures, surrounding countries during this time. And we can now begin to speak much more confidently about the history of Tibet in these formative years when Buddhism was first entering Tibetan culture. According to the Tibetan Chronicles, King Songtsen Gampo, who reigned roughly from 609 to 649, invited one of his two Buddhist wives to help him introduce the cult of the Buddha to Tibet. What this meant was to introduce a statue of the Buddha in Tibet and establish the Buddha as a focus of worship. According to the stories, the first attempts to build a temple in the capital city of Lhasa were unsuccessful. The carts that were carrying the Buddha's statue bogged down in the swamps, and it was impossible for them to construct the temple that they had hoped to build. In a dream, the king was told that the land of Tibet lay on the body of a demoness who had to be subdued before the cult of the Buddha could be successfully established. So he ordered a series of temples to be built around the country that were understood as pinning down her knees and her elbows and her hips and her shoulders. Finally, a temple was built in Lhasa, in the center of the capital city, to pin down her heart. This temple is known as the Jokhang today. It's the most sacred temple in Tibet. It's the focus of Buddhist pilgrimage to the capital of Lhasa, and it is the site of the Jo-o Rinpoche, Songtsen Gampo's first Buddha image and the holiest image in traditional Tibet. Now, the actions of Songtsen Gampo, as you can imagine, not only subdued the demoness that constituted the Tibetan landscape, and you might say in some ways the subconscious identity of the Tibetan people themselves, but it marked Tibet with a form of a mandala that could be traced by pilgrims as they made their way from the fringes of the Tibetan plateau into this holy site in the center. Now, I should say, I think, as we begin to dig here into the history of Tibet, that a lot of the Tibetan names that I'm pronouncing to you will seem a bit unfamiliar and certainly nothing like what we have been talking about in our elaborate use of Pali and Sanskrit in our discussion of the Indian tradition. And I probably should tell you something just for a moment about the Tibetan language. I'll be using a pronunciation of these words that's something like the contemporary pronunciation, but the spelling of Tibetan was settled quite a while ago, shortly after the introduction of Buddhism to Tibet, and it's been standardized since that time. So the way we spell Tibetan is quite different than the way we pronounce it. If you have the written version of this course, you'll find in the glossary both the traditional spelling of the Tibetan names and also their modern pronunciations. If you want to imagine what the difference between them is like, you might just simply contemplate the difference between spelling and pronunciation of our word knight. You know, the knight in shining armor who came to rescue the fair maiden from the castle back there in the fables of our Western culture. If we pronounced what we write, it would sound like knicht, I suppose, something like that. But we pronounce it knight. A lot of Tibetan words are like this. They have very complicated spellings and very simple pronunciations. One of my favorite is the word B-S-G-R-U-B-S. I suppose if you pronounced it literally, it would be busgrubs. It means something like proven or established in a philosophical sense. It's spelled busgrubs, and it's pronounced d. And therein lies one of the great problems for a beginning student of the Tibetan tradition.